WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Breakfast at Tiffany's, Truman Capote's book, the iconic movie with the unforgettable Audrey Hepburn. Now, a Broadway play, the story of Holly Golightly, the poor country girl who moves to New York City and is almost remade, Jay Gatsby in a little black dress, working brilliantly, fiercely with what she's got. This hour On Point, Breakfast at Tiffany's and the American Imagination. Again, you can join the conversation. What's given Holly Golightly and Breakfast at Tiffany's such staying power, such magnetism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Theme from the 1961 movie version behind us right there. We will hear in a few minutes from the director of the new Broadway stage version of Breakfast at Tiffany's, Sean Mathias. But joining me first from New York is Gina Belafonte, columnist and critic for the New York Times. She's reread Truman Capote's novella Breakfast at Tiffany's and written about it for the Times Big City Book Club series. Gina, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Stephanie Cohen, arts and entertainment writer for the Wall Street Journal. She's just reread the book, watched Audrey Hepburn in the movie again, and seen the new Broadway play. Stephanie, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, hi, Tom.
So you're writing on the new play that may surprise people when they see it. If the film is what they have in mind, why, Stephanie?
Well, it follows the book that Truman Capote wrote much more closely than the film does. The film has, you know, an iconic stature in American society, but it really is not the novella that Capote had written. There's a perfect Hollywood ending, and the profession that, you know, Holly that Holly's supposed to have is sort of whitewashed in order to not alienate audiences. So it's the novella is a much sort of bleaker, grittier look at life in New York in the pre-war.
It got glammed up in a hurry in the hands of Audrey Hepburn. I mean, she could hardly help her, put her in the little black dress, put her on the streets of New York, and there was a glamour, even as she talked about not just the blues but the mean reds when she would really get down. I got a little tape here from the film. She says the only thing that would calm her down would be to, head to Tiffany's. Audrey Hepburn, 1961, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
The only thing that does any good is to jump into a cab and go to Tiffany's. Calms me down right away. The quietness and the proud look of it. Nothing very bad could happen to you there. If I could find a real life place that made me feel like Tiffany's, then I'd buy some furniture and give the cat a name.
Audrey Hepburn, 1961. Gina Belafonte, you write about Breakfast at Tiffany's as a magnificent, economical account of a failed reinvention in your city, Gina. When you went back and read the book, how did it hit you?
Well, it reminded me of so many women who have come to the city both before and after, in the 30s and the, you know, 60s and 70s, who come with grand visions, either for either they're ambitious and coming with grand visions of professional careers that are going to launch them into a world of wealth, or they're coming to meet the rich guy. And then you see those women, and I certainly have in my life, you know, go back to hometowns far away. The city can really beat you up and you know, impede your ideas, and that's why the book is very haunting to me, because it just remains something. It is very much of a moment and very much speaks to a reality that I feel still in the city today.
Take us back beyond the movie, which sort of still dazzles in so many ways, even though it can be fairly tough in its own right. But take us back to the book and the basic story there, Gina, if you'd be good enough.
Yeah, well, the basic story is about a young woman who comes to New York to escape what we come to see as a pretty bad life of Southern poverty and sadness and sexist. And she comes to be her own person and to live a beautiful life, a glamorous life. And she has this friend who is her confidant, who is the Capote character. He's never named in the novel, but he takes a great affection for her. And she is a prostitute. And that's made quite explicit in the book. That is the way that she is earning her keep and buying her clothes. And, you know, that doesn't turn out very favorably in the end.
Yeah, here's a little bit. It's really dressed up in the movie. Audrey Hepburn here, who goes on in the movie, she goes on many dates, but doesn't seem to like any of the men. She's glossing over what's really going on, but not entirely. She calls these guys rats, says she uses them for $50 for the powder room.
Every Tom, Dick, and Sid thinks that if he takes a girl to dinner, she'll just curl up like a kitten in a little furry ball at his feet. Right? I have, by actual count, been taken to dinner by 26 different rats in the last 2 months. 27, if you count Benny Shackley, who's in many ways a super rat.
Super. Stephanie, what was it about this, the movie, that just caught people? And I mean, I think I know quite a number of women in the years since who imagine playing out some version of this, maybe this sort of prettied up movie version. But the image of her in the little black dress, the image of Audrey Hepburn in New York, made it incredibly glamorous, even though there was a big struggle going on underneath here for her and for many in this book and in this film.
I think the answer is Audrey Hepburn. I think she just was so stylish. I mean, the gowns were designed by Givenchy, and she had these, you know, tiaras and these beautiful necklaces and her cigarette holder. And she had that gamine look, so she was sort of innocent. And it was, you were able to sort of see her as this girl about town that didn't have this dark side, because she wasn't this voluptuous, you know, Marilyn Monroe type. She was... had these big saucer eyes and this very boyish little figure, and her, you know, irrepressible sort of attitude and the way she just had these crazy phrases made her just adorable, and America just fell completely in love with her. I don't think the movie itself probably is, you know, the best romantic comedy of all time, but it is certainly one of the most well-loved, and I think she is probably why.
Gina, what was she ever part of your, I don't know, dream life? You're in New York. Did you have a...
Yes.
Holly Go Lightly kind of Audrey Hepburn image somewhere dancing in your mind?
I had always had the fantasy of moving to New York and writing, and she was certainly just hugely influential, that character, in tying style and fashion to whatever your dream was going to be in New York. You know, you couldn't just slob around, you had to look a certain part, and that kind of you know, the shift dress, the black shift dress, something I used to write about fashion every year. You'd always see one on the runway. It never, never, never goes out of our vernacular, you know? And it certainly gives a girl an impression that you have to maintain a certain kind of appearance to succeed in any realm in New York, I think.
It's interesting. Truman Capote, who lived in New York, whose mother had come to New York and may in part have been the model, though people talk about Gloria Vanderbilt and many others, he envisioned Marilyn Monroe for this role, a very different, you know, less less lean, but more like what he describes in the book, Gina, sort of a blonde country background, not Audrey Hepburn's British upbringing, not this sophisticated, almost aristocrat.
Right, exactly. And of course, you know, he was very committed to that idea, and the studios, when they were talking about the film, would not sign on, because that would have implied much more obviously what the actual subject of the book is. So in the studio's view, Marilyn Monroe was way, way, way too sexual for this character. So Audrey Hepburn was selected in a sense because she, her thinness or her hauteur, in a way, as charming as it is very de-eroticized.
Here's Hepburn. This was a 1961 interview after a charity premiere of the film Breakfast at Tiffany's in London. She's trying to characterize what kind of girl Holly Golightly is. We hear the interviewer first, then Audrey Hepburn, 1961.
What sort of a girl is she?
She's a, what they call in America these days, a kook.
What does that mean? Spelled with a K, I believe.
Which is a dizzy, gay type of girl.
Anything like you?
I'm not quite that way, no.
Audrey Hepburn not in character in 1961. And she sees Holly Golightly, Stephanie, as a kook. What do you say to that?
I mean, she is. She's a little bit nutty. Absolutely. But she's trying to, I mean, I think that she's trying to reinvent herself. She's coming, as you know, we said, from this backwater, and she takes this sort of strange cosmopolitan accent that doesn't really make any sense. because she was going to be an actress at one point, and they tried to take out the Southern in her voice, so she ends up with this weird continental accent, and she has these funny phrases. And then, you know, it's what makes the character of Fred, of Truman, fall in love with her, because she's just so strange and bizarre and glamorous. But yeah, I think they had to sell it as a kook because they couldn't say what it really was.
Is it a book that we can talk more easily about today, Genia, or does it still kind of rub up against the tough side of reinvention in America?
Yes, I think, you know, we can think about the book today more in terms of class time, in terms of class and all the impediments to mobility than we would have perhaps when it came out and you looked at it and it was thought about more in terms of gender and sexuality and the difficulties women would face getting, let's say, any kind of remunerative work. And now it just seems as though it's just harder and harder to come to New York and come from quote-unquote nowhere, not have the privileged beginnings, the fancy education, and get anywhere.
Genia Belafonte, please stand by in New York. Stephanie Cohen as well. We're talking about Breakfast at Tiffany's. We'll talk with the director of the new Broadway stage play in a moment. Here's Audrey Hepburn singing Moon River in the film. 800-423-8255. Did you want to be her? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River and me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Breakfast at Tiffany's, the book, the movie, the play now on Broadway, and the story's place in the American imagination. Truman Capote, Audrey Hepburn, Holly Golightly, the look, the attitude, the story beneath. Genia Belafonte is with us from the New York Times, joins us from New York City. Stephanie Cohen's here, arts and entertainment writer for the Wall Street Journal. She's seen the new play. We'll talk in a moment with the director, Sean Mathias, and you can join us. Did Breakfast at Tiffany's enchant you, capture your young mind, enthrall you, even though it's a tough story? And is it all Audrey Hepburn to you, the waif, the jewels, the little black dress? What about the backstory, the poor Texas runaway, the sex for cash, the desperation? Should the glamour, the reinvention outshine all that? Did you want to be Holly Golightly? Why? Truman Capote wrote the novella, came out in 1958. Here he is reading from the novella, Breakfast at Tiffany's. This is April 7th, 1963. The scene is just after Holly Golightly enters the narrator's apartment via the fire escape.
I'd never seen her before, not wearing dark glasses, and it was obvious now that they were prescription lenses, for without them her eyes had an assessing squint, like a jeweler's. They were large eyes, a little blue, a little green, dotted with bits of brown, varicolored, like her hair, and, like her hair, they gave out a lively, warm light. I suppose you think I'm very brazen or trefou or something. Not at all. She seemed disappointed. Yes, you do. Everybody does. I don't mind. It's useful.
Truman Capote, in that inimitable voice of his, reading from his novella there in 1963. Genia, he had been living in New York when he wrote this. What about his mindset as he looked out on the city, his own personal history, other potential models for Holly Golightly?
Yes. Well, you know, he was writing and meeting all kinds of young people and in the literary world. And, of course, you know, his mother had come up north and found a wealthy husband. And so many people, you know, see her as the model. I have always been particularly fond of a theory that she was inspired by a writer named Maeve Brennan at The New Yorker, who was extremely beautiful in a very, very Audrey-ish way, very stylish, was an Irish writer who was of immense talent and wound up sleeping at the New Yorker offices toward the end of her life, homeless, dissolute, dissipate. She was an alcoholic, and, you know, it all sort of unraveled for her, and she was a person who had, you know, crossed these kind of gender gaps, made it into this world, was privileged, and she still could not, you know, sustain a stable life here.
Stephanie, people talk about this as a kind of transmogrified version of the Great Gatsby, almost. Different story, different place, but the idea of reinvention and the darkness that can be there. I mean, it's not just the darkness of her personal history. She's asked in the book how many men she slept with, and I think she says, well, you know, those before 13 don't count, right? I mean, it's really sort of raggedy, tough upbringing there. But what about the darkness in New York itself in the book, Stephanie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Truman paints a really interesting picture of how a woman, as Genia said, how a woman would support herself and would be able to wear these kinds of clothes and have her own apartment. But I think in the movie, it is made into, I think it was really groundbreaking to see someone paying their own way. And you know, they didn't really deal with the actual nature of how she was doing it. Mm-hmm. But you know, and then there's the whole question of what happens to her in the end, in the novella.
She's looking for a rich guy to latch on to. She ends up, well, Brazil is in there and a statue from Africa. What?
Yeah, I mean, you get the feeling that she probably survived and did okay for herself.
I think she survives. I think she's a survivor.
We've got Sean Mathias right there with us, joining us from New York, director of the new Broadway play Breakfast at Tiffany's at the Court Theater in New York City. British actor, writer, director. Sean, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What gave you the impulse to bring this back, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and bring it to the stage in this way?
Well, I think probably it is, you know, Truman Capote in his writing. when the title came to me and I was told it was going to be done on the stage, I was very wary because, of course, the movie is so iconic and so successful and so beloved. And I thought, why would you want to try and reinvent this now? But then going back to read the book, I was reminded of what a wonderful book it was, what an amazing writer he was, and he'd had quite an influence on my life and someone I'd always admired. And I thought this is a very extraordinary story that hasn't been examined in this way. So it would be fascinating to try and, you know, adapt it from book to stage in all its darkness, in all its complexities. And I mean, it's an extraordinary, challenging piece because it's full of lightness and a kind of sort of very hard to pin down quality because of who this girl is with the many masks she's wearing. But at its root, there's tremendous soul, there's tremendous sort of empathy, there's a tremendous struggle, a sort of very difficult hardship in her background. And it was fascinating to work on these aspects of it, all from the Capote book.
I want to ask you about casting here. Let me read just a little bit. This is Capote's work, the narrator in the novella Breakfast at Tiffany's, and describing when he first meets Holly Golightly, he's astounded by the variety, he says, in her physical appearance. Reading here from Capote, it was a warm evening, nearly summer, and she wore a slim, cool black dress, black sandals, a pearl choker. For all her chic thinness, she had an almost breakfast cereal air of health, a soap and lemon cleanness. Her mouth was large, her nose upturned. It was a face beyond childhood, yet this side of belonging to a woman. I thought her anywhere between 16 and 30. As it turned out, she was 2 months shy of her 19th birthday. How did you cast for this role, Sean Mathias?
Well, that's, you know, there's your first challenge, isn't it? Yeah. I think that I did the play in London in a different version, mm-hmm. a different version by a different writer with different actors, different designers, and I loved working. It was wonderful. There were certain things we wanted to change and sort of make different and improve upon. And one of the main things was I really wanted to see if I could cast Holly Golightly with an actress who was very, very young, and that's exactly what's happened. I'm not sure how old Amelia is. She's probably about 25, but a 25-year-old is perfect to play a 19-year-old. And
this
it's
is
not
Amelia
Holly.
Clark who plays on stage for you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Amelia mm-hmm. Clark plays Holly in our production. Mm-hmm. And it's not that Holly has to be 19. She is literally two months shy of 19. But as he says, she could be anywhere between 16 and 30. She just has to. I think that description. There's a child still there, and she's not quite a woman. I think that is the quality of youth that I was really looking for, and I think Amelia brings that to it.
Let me play a little back to back here. First from the movie 1961, Audrey Hepburn, Holly Golightly, and George Papard playing Paul Varjak fall in love, but it's hard for Holly to give up her independent life for Paul.
Holly, I'm in love with you.
So what?
So what? So plenty. I love you. You belong to me.
No. People don't belong to people.
Of course they do.
I'm not going to let anyone put me in a cage.
I don't want to put you in a cage. I want to love you.
The same thing.
No, it's not. Holly?
I'm not Holly. I'm not Lula May either. I don't know who I am. I'm like Cat here. We're a couple of no-name slobs. We belong to nobody, and nobody belongs to us. We don't even belong to each other.
There from the movie. Doesn't sound like she came from rural Texas. Hard to say where that voice came from exactly. It's all Audrey Hepburn here from the stage play, directed by my guest Sean Mathias. Holly Golightly, played by Amelia Clark, meets the same Fred, played here by Corey Michael Smith.
You're Miss Holiday Golightly.
Only to my creditors.
I
don't mean it. I don't have creditors. I'm cash only. What I mean is, you'll call me Holly.
And you can call me...
Fred. Yes, I know. I've already started.
There we are on stage. Stephanie, you've seen the play. The book is darker than the movie. Where does the play come down?
I think that the play follows really closely to the book. And... I had spoken to the literary trustee of Truman Capote's estate, who has not granted stage rights to Breakfast at Tiffany's to anyone ever. And you know, since Truman was alive, I think it was the last time it was performed. But he liked this version because he felt like it would allow Truman's book to be, you know, it would enhance his legacy, because Truman famously did not like the movie, and Alan Schwartz, the trustee, he read the script and said, "This is what Truman would have liked. This is the, you know, art he was trying to create." So, it feels very similar to the book.
Gina, I know I have to let you go. Parting thoughts on Breakfast at Tiffany's what lasts?
I wanted to say something else actually about reinvention, which
yes,
I always thought of Breakfast at Tiffany's. Watching Sex and the City, not for the obvious reasons that it took place in New York and that, you know, the women all wore beautiful clothes. But two things, you know, it was comical the way they never, their salaries never could ever possibly accommodate the kind of wardrobes they acquired. But two, I always thought one of the most interesting things about the show, which got very, very, very little or if any attention, was that you'd never, ever see the family members of the characters in the show. You don't know anything about the family members. And the point is, you know, I asked the creator of the show what the point, and his point was people come to New York to invent themselves, and that when we see characters, you know, divorced from these family situations, you really see how you experience New York, and I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, no kidding. Into the Big City, reinvention, a theme that's replayed again and again and again. Gina Belafonte, columnist and critic for the New York Times. Gina, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me so much. Bye-bye.
Sean Mathias, you've got it on stage, and we've got women lined up out the door to talk about Holly Golightly, calling in from all over. Let's go to New York, Poughkeepsie, New York. Nancy's calling. Hi, Nancy, you're on the air.
Okay, hi. Well, for a teenager from the Bronx, this movie was absolutely classy. Audrey Hepburn was absolutely classy. I left the dark theater to face the sunlight reluctantly, and maybe it was about reinvention in those days, wanting to leave the Bronx and, you know, live a different kind of life. It was a great movie. I still think about it.
Do you dream of being that girl in that dress with that tiara?
That in those days, yes, not now.
Nancy, thanks very much. One more right here. Sherry calling, Greenport, New York. Sherry, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I can't tell you how many times during my life I've said that I wanted to be Holly Golightly. I was in prep school in New England. My parents took me to see Breakfast at Tiffany's at Radio City Music Hall. And that completely changed my life. I wanted to be Holly Golightly.
She was glamorous. She was Audrey Hepburn. Did you understand she was a call girl, prostitute?
Well, I think I was a bit naive at the time. I was a young girl in prep school. I fell for the glamour, the New York.
Yeah.
And when I graduated from prep school, I went to college in New York, and I became a disco girl. And now I
was that your version of Holly Golightly, Sherry?
In a way, yes. I was going to art school, so I had busted out of prep school, and all the rules were not there anymore.
Art school,
no
disco
talking to boys in the street, white gloves, stockings and heels to dinner.
All done with that. When you went back to art school in New York, I bet with that Holly Golightly model in mind. Sherry, thanks for calling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And one more. It's just too good. Lauren in Guilford, Connecticut. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually in my late 20s, and I first was introduced to Breakfast at Tiffany's with my grandmother. And ever since then, I had this, not obsession, but I just loved Audrey Hepburn, went to watching her whole movie collection. And now, anytime I see the image of Audrey Hepburn or the Breakfast at Tiffany's, it kind of brings me back to the time with my grandmother. And even just that icon, seeing that vintage style, really kind of just brings me back. And I think it's a lot to say for my generation that Audrey Hepburn really represents our relationships with our older generations, and really kind of she brings us back. And I just really had to say that because your show is just perfect for me.
Is it her style, her personal beauty and carriage, or is it the story itself, or is that beside the point for you, Lauren?
I think it was how Audrey portrayed the character. I think the story was great. Living in Connecticut, we were very close to New York, so I was able to identify with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But Audrey Hepburn just brought such personalization to the character that really brought out who she was. And I think it was really just a great depiction.
Lauren, thanks so much for your call. Sean Mathias, you're directing it right now. What a challenge with this iconic image and floating in so many American people's minds. I mean, how do you do it? How do you direct Emilia Clarke to find her own way through the original work?
Well, of course, it's a challenge, but that you've got to make that decision when you decide to do it in the first place. You've got to realize the might and the weight of the icon. And, I mean, I love the movie, and I also love Audrey Hepburn. I love her movies. So having great respect and admiration for someone is a big help. Then what you do is you don't go and look at the movie. You don't go and look at Audrey Hepburn movies. You get right away from her because you can't recreate or challenge or compete with her or with the film. You've got to do your own thing. So what you do is you go back to Capote. You go back to the book, and you find all your inspiration from the book. The book is only one of his many works, and his own personal story and personal life, which you've been discussing here, was a very colourful and rather tragic one as well. And so it's not a surprise that although this was it's a novella, and it's in some ways a lighter book, certainly made a lighter movie, it's not surprising that the dark elements are in there because of the man that Capote revealed himself to be through his life. So really, all the inspiration is from him and from his writing. To find someone who can play Holly Golightly, what I kind of say in my head is, if you're doing Hamlet, there are many, many, many great Hamlets. If you're doing Antony and Cleopatra, there are many, many great Antonys and Cleopatras. Why can't there be more than one Holly Golightly? So I just approached it in the same way I would approach a play, from that sense of I'm looking for a Holly Golightly for now.
And the core of the character that you've directed Emilia Clarke to play, if you articulate it to Emilia, what do you say of it, Holly's core?
Well, I think that what we started working on was we probably started working more on the mask, on the outside in this sense, because of the difficult style or the particular style that's in the story that we have to find. And, of course, the style is very much to do with the era as well, and it's set in wartime New York. New York was a very, very particular
1940s,
place.
1940s,
a lot of people coming through the city, a lot of soldiers and sailors are stopping off on leave, a lot of people are having a lot of sex, a very promiscuous time, and an urgent time in people's lives when you had to prove that you were alive because it might be the moment before you died. So it was quite an extreme time.
Sean Mathias, stand by right there if you would for a moment. We have to take a quick break here. So good to have you with us. Director of the new stage play, Broadway version of Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Stephanie Cohen, arts and entertainment writer for the Wall Street Journal. It's so great to have you with us. Behind us, right here, Emilia Clarke. You may know her from Game of Thrones. Here she plays Holly Golightly. She's singing I Am a Traveling Creature from the Broadway version. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What do you see in Holly Golightly? Carrie Bradshaw, The Great Gatsby, just Audrey Hepburn, or maybe now Emilia Clarke? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
She gave to me her hand. Mother, hold my hand. Hold up my dying day. should ever try to pray.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Breakfast at Tiffany's, the book, the movie, the play, now on Broadway, and the story's place in the American imagination. Truman Capote, Audrey Hepburn, Holly Golightly, the look, the attitude, the story of reinvention or the effort in New York City. Sean Mathias is with us. He's director of the new Broadway play, Breakfast at Tiffany's. It's at the Court Theater in New York City. Director, writer, actor. Stephanie Cohen's here, arts and entertainment writer for The Wall Street Journal. Also joining us from New York, she's seen the play. You can join us. What about Holly Golightly? Who do you see in her? What do you see in her? What about Fred, the stand-in for Truman Capote, gay in the book with his nose sort of up against the glass of society in those days, those years? What's the Breakfast at Tiffany's magic? Dark side? Light side? The message now? Here from the play, the stage play version on Broadway right now, Fred, the narrator in the novella, really kind of standing in for Truman Capote, played here by Corey Michael Smith, and Holly, played by Amelia Clark, talk about Holly's dates for the evening.
And who are your friends?
It's the awful thing. I haven't got any. I'm unutterably alone.
The gentleman at the table, I mean?
Oh, these. Quelle hilarité, I forgot they were there. Mr. Luce. Mr. Rockefeller. Fred.
Fred.
The gentleman at the table. And they do go home with Holly Golightly. Gary writes online, the very definition of a classy actress in a wonderful performance that continues to mesmerize Hepburn there. Now it's on stage. But Jandy writes, Sean, Stephanie, says, well, color me naive. I'm listening to On Point right now. I didn't know she was a prostitute or a call girl. I really thought she was a party girl trying to find satisfaction in the New York social nightlife. I mean, Sean, is it dead obvious from the book that she is, in fact, a prostitute? I'm reading here Truman Capote. This is in a Playboy interview in 1968. He says, well, not precisely a call girl. Says, you know, she'd be accompanied by expense account men to the best restaurants and nightclubs with the understanding that her escort was obligated to give her some sort of gift, perhaps jewelry or a check. These girls were the authentic American geishas, and they're much more prevalent now, he's saying, in 68 than in 43 or 44, which was Holly's era. How did you read that role, Sean?
Well, I think that's just like that. I've never once called her a prostitute, and I've avoided the term call girl. I've been very careful about how we approach it.
And yet there's a compensation that we see there.
She does receive financial compensation, and she does say in that passage when she says about having sex before she was 13, she does say that she's only had 11 lovers. So, I mean, my interpretation is that if she can avoid sexual favors with these men that she receives money from, she does. I think if the going gets tough, she sleeps with them. I mean, she's dating Rusty Trawler, who's a very, very rich a pickled infant, as Capote calls it,
yeah.
A rich sort of rather ghastly fascist. She implies that she is willing to marry him if she's a gold digger, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like a number of other girls who didn't have independence. It's very much of its time, of its era. These girls did not have careers. They were expected to marry. And there were a bunch of these girls, probably a great number of them that Capote knew, who were in New York looking for rich husbands. One of the people, she's apparently an amalgam of several different women.
Mm.
I knew one of the women rather well that she was based on. That's Una Chaplin. Una Chaplin, widow of Charlie and daughter of the great Eugene O'Neill.
Mm.
And Una Chaplin became a friend of mine, and she's sadly no longer with us, but rather ironic. I smile ironically to myself to think that I actually knew somebody who made up some kind of element of Holly Golightly. But so I've never thought of her in my head as a prostitute, no.
Ben Brantley writes in the New York Times on the play and looking back to the book, says Breakfast at Tiffany's is one of the great gossamer illusions of American fiction. Every word in it is planted with care and exactitude, yet it seems to be woven from starlight. Even when we're talking about sort of really down and dirty country poverty and loss of parents and how many men before age 13. Tina in Warrensburg, New York. Tina, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hello.
I equate her to Don Quixote of Mayo La Mancha because, you know, his tragic and fragile nature made him look at Dulcinea as the beauty that he had to survive the horrors of his situation.
Mm-hmm.
Just as Holly Golightly had her wardrobe and her her personality trying to hide and deceive herself from what she was really living in.
Yes, I love it, Tina. Thanks for that. Stephanie Cohen, how about it? I mean, she does. There's the passage in the book where she says, even when you're with these men who are one way or another kind of paying for her sexual company, there's something about, I can't remember the exact, but you've got to sort of love them while you're with them. There's a, what is it? There is a Don Quixote kind of, I'm not sure how to put it,
know,
but she's got her own dream going on, even when things are pretty rough around her.
Yeah, she, you know, when her husband comes looking for her, Doc Golightly, when she sees
much older,
him, you kind
comes
of...
comes up from Texas, was it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
She had married her when she was 14 and starving, and he had taken her and her brother, Fred, in. And he comes to the door, and he's sort of been stalking her, and you don't know how she's going to react. You think she's going to probably recoil in horror when this, you know, 60-something man comes to claim her. And she looks at him with such love, and she tells Fred later that she did spend the night with him and that she, you know, did love him because he took care of her and he was kind to her and he, mm-hmm. you know, set her free. So you do get the feeling that she has... she's not as crass about it as you would think.
Yeah.
Although she is going to marry Rusty Trawler, who is played, you know, to the hilt as a sort of buffoon.
Would try to anyway for the golds that's there. We've got a little tape of Amelia Clark in the Broadway play On Now telling Fred what her parents were like.
Sorry, darling. I know that your sweet cliche of a heart has me down as a waif. It wasn't that way at all. Oh, my parents were nice and scatty.
Nice and scatty back in Texas. Jean in Brattleboro, Vermont. Jean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a psychotherapist, and my sense of Holly, as I've seen that film as an adult, has always been that she's an incest survivor, which led her to prostitution. There is a very strong connection between prostitution and having had an incest history.
Mm.
There's also an underlying despair in her, it's obvious. And that's always been my sense of her, that she's an incest survivor.
I can well understand how you come to that as a psychotherapist, or just reading, just watching. What do you say, Sean?
Well, she says that she doesn't count any sexual contact she had before she was 13. So she implies there was sexual contact before 13. She doesn't talk about it. Doc Golightly, who takes her in when she's 14, says she's come from some no good people. I think that's the phrase. So she's obviously there is a suggestion there's been some abuse in her early life. Her parents died of TB. Her and her brother were abandoned. They were all, I guess there might have been more brothers and sisters. They were farmed out to different places. And they lived, what in my British mind I would consider a sort of Dickensian, a Victorian Dickensian childhood. You'd have your absolute equivalent of that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's coming up before the great drought in the South and all of that time. So it's a time of tremendous hardship. And the notion that she was abused and quite possibly sexually abused is not in any way far-fetched.
The gussying up of that country poverty character then, Stephanie, in the movie that Blake Edwards brought us and Audrey Hepburn, I mean, what was involved in vaulting Audrey Hepburn's depiction up to this sort of very classy image, even as she struggles with that history? What are the theatrical tricks that made that possible in the movie, Stephanie?
I think a lot of it is... they say in the movie, in the book, that she, as I said, had to learn a new way of speaking. Mm-hmm. And she just ends up with this very bizarre accent, which is, you know... It's sort of how film actors would have talked at the time,
mm-hmm.
that continental
yes.
voice. But then, you know, Audrey Hepburn brought in her own designer to design the gowns because she had worked with Givenchy before. And so, you know, she had access to him. And Edith Head, I guess, was the costume designer. But they were based on his designs. And one of them just sold, I think, for almost $1 million.
Wow.
At Sotheby's, one of the little black dresses that she wore.
So you've seen Sean's direction here, his version on Broadway now. Does he take it back in a more earthy direction, Stephanie? Is it more like what we might expect from Tennessee Williams or something? Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Glass Menagerie? What?
Well, in the sense of how Fred is looking back on his life in, you know, in the 40s and his time knowing Holly. Yes, I think that that is – that could be described, yeah. But I think it's what he does is really transgressive, actually, because a lot of what's going on, it's these almost teenagers that befriend each other. They're really each other's first friends. They're not lovers. Mm-hmm. But they both have questions about their sexuality and about who they want to become and recreating themselves, as we've said. And it's actually really modern, I feel. Mm-hmm. And they talk about – there's references in the book and in the play to – Holly's sexuality, too, which is what interesting that this therapist had said, you know, maybe she was an incest survivor, because there's, you know, some hint that maybe she's a lesbian as well, and she isn't, you know, completely not turned on by these men at all.
Sean,
and Fred certainly has his sexuality is not nearly as ambivalent as it is when played by George Peppard.
Pretty much straight up gay, as with Capote. Fred, what feels 40s or 50s, what feels very contemporary about this now to you, directing?
Well, I think I suppose the proof of its modernness is the fact that it appeals to young people. I think, as Stephanie just put it, it's really a story. Everyone thinks it's about Holly Golightly. Of course, it is. She's the most famous name, the most iconic character. Like I said, up there with Hamlet and Antony and Cleopatra and other great characters from literature. But it's a story about two people, about Holly and Fred, about a mm-hmm. girl and a boy. They're both ambivalent in their sexuality. They're both ambivalent in their hopes. They're ambitious and they're opportunistic, but they're sort of also slight. Their two characters are slightly lost. And I think the poignancy of the story, and also the other major characters, New York City. They're two characters, two youngsters who've come to New York City to find out what their dreams are and how to live their dreams. I think that story is so applicable now, and I think that young people come and see this this production, and they are very, very arrested by it, very seduced by it, very taken by the story and the dance that these two late teenagers, early 20-year-olds are playing.
The themes seem right up to date. Breakfast at Tiffany's. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Adele is calling. Adele, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I am just curious why the discussion never goes to why young people are attracted to a life of prostitution, essentially. The movie makes it look gorgeous, put a great dress on it, but essentially it's a tragic, awful movie that keeps getting dressed up into this lovely thing that it's not. And I think there's a conversation that's missing.
I mean, thanks, Adele. I mean, you point to what our caller from Vermont, our psychotherapist, says. Look, many who end up in prostitution begin with incest. I guess the tragedy is baked right in there. But Stephanie, there's no question that, I mean, by the time you get to Blake Edwards' treatment of this, it I don't know if whitewashed is the right word, but it's a little black dressed into something quite glamorous. Is that a travesty? Is that just the way it needed to be to make the silver screen in 61?
Well, yes, but I mean, that tradition is, look at Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
Look at Julia Roberts, and it's exactly the same story, and she's very explicit about having been abused, I think. I think she says at some point in the movie. And then, you know, it's the hooker with the heart of gold. I cannot answer why that's a mythology that Americans love so much, but redeeming the wayward woman and giving her Cinderella dream is... for whatever reason, an American myth that, I think the caller has a good point. It is a little unsettling.
Though the darkness is certainly around it in the novella, and the darkness from everything I'm reading is around it in your portrayal, Sean. It's not as though this is all glitzed up.
Well, she's not a great American heroine. She's mm-hmm. an anti-heroine. In fact, what she does is she leaves America and she goes off to Brazil, and then she's spotted in Africa. She's not a patriot. She's not. She's a sort of clumsy, strange, complex character, and she's not full of heroic qualities. And I think that's why the writing is so interesting. And probably what's paradoxical in it is the style in which he wrote it, the precision, like whatever Brantley in the Times said about the particularness mm-hmm. of each word. The precision which he writes is so extraordinary. Enlightening, and it's that very shapes, lights, touch, that beautiful precision, mixed in with this slightly murky story about this girl who's been abused, who's a farm girl, who's been around chickens and hens and horses and animals and birds, and who strums out country songs and a guitar.
And Moon River. This,
yeah. Well, in their case, Moon River. Yeah. In our case, yes. Something else.
Yes.
And is living this very sort of extraordinary, glamorous, painted on this. I keep coming back to the word mask, and Capote himself used the word, compared these girls to geishas. And of course, what one associates with a geisha is the mask, the beautifully mm-hmm. painted on mask. And that's what Holly has. And what I've loved about doing it is trying to create the mask and trying to then smash it and see what lies beneath.
Ben Brantley writing about Capote's clear-eyed portrait as well as a misty-eyed look at a child woman of infinite caprice. That catches something right there. It is amazing how it hangs on, Stephanie. You know, if we wanted to, we could have had women nonstop on the air, all calling in this hour saying, that was my model, that was my inspiration, and yet all this trouble lies there. It's an amazing juxtaposition, kind of contradiction, isn't it, Stephanie?
It is, but I think it does, in some ways, I think Sean's right. I don't think she is a heroine until you see her in the movie, and that Audrey portrayal is really, I think, what captured everyone.
Let Hollywood,
and made her into that hero.
Yeah, let Hollywood get a hold of it, and there it goes. Sean Mathias, in his new stage version on Broadway, takes us back much closer to the original Truman Capote. Sean, good luck with the show. Good luck with the play. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Director, wonderful to have you. Director Sean Mathias. And Stephanie Cohen, arts and entertainment writer for The Wall Street Journal. You're so generous and insightful today with us, Stephanie. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
One more touch of Henry Mancini from Blake Edwards' very gussied up movie version, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.